You're listening to Climate Now. I'm James Lawler, and today's episode is a part of our Decarbonizing Electricity series. According to the International Energy Agency, more than 40% of energy-related CO2 emissions globally come from electricity generation. Every time we turn on a light or plug in, we are connecting to the electricity grid, which pulls power from multiple sources of generation, like gas, coal, wind, solar, nuclear, hydropower, and transports it to the outlet so that we have electricity at any given hour of the day. But how does electricity get from the point of generation to the point of consumption? With more solar and wind coming onto the grid to decarbonize generation, what do we need to do to ensure a continuous supply of electricity even when the wind isn't blowing and the sun isn't shining? Aside from transitioning power generation away from fossil fuels, what investments can be made to reduce energy consumption? Today, we're speaking with Monica Varman, who focuses on investments in grid resilience at G2 Venture Partners. We spoke with Monica about the electricity grid. How is it constructed? What are the major components? How does it work? How might it be improved? And what investment opportunities exist along those lines? Monica previously served as an advisor on sustainability practices at McKinsey & Company and worked in business operations at Tesla during the development of the Model S electric car. Monica, it's great to have you on the podcast today. Thanks so much for joining us.
Yeah, thanks so much for having me.
Excellent. So let's start with your background. How did you get to where you are today in your career?
Well, I'm really passionate about sustainability and have been throughout my career. I developed that interest in college, just trying to merge my interest for economic development and increasing opportunity across the planet without destroying it. I grew up in India and the Middle East. So I was born in India, lived in the Middle East until I was 10, moved back to India until I was 17, and then moved to the US. And I think those experiences were really formative in developing both my passion for increasing the level of opportunity across the planet and my realization of how much harm can be done when that's not done with a view toward environment. So for me, that led me to an interest in sustainable development, which then by exploring both public and private sector paths, I ended up developing more of an affinity for exploring how technology can help unlock sustainable development. And ultimately, for me, venture capital was a really great way to merge my endless curiosity to learn and grow with my passion for early stage technology.
So today, one of the topics that we want to cover with you is the electricity grid and decarbonizing the grid. This is an area that you have some experience in. I'm wondering if you could start by describing to us how the electricity grid functions. So the major players, what does each player do? You know, by what miracle is it such that one can walk into a room and turn on a light switch and actually have the light go on?
Yeah, absolutely. So the grid has three pieces. There's generation, transmission, and then distribution. So the first piece, generation, can include natural gas plants. It can include utility scale solar, utility scale wind, nuclear power plants, even coal. The second piece, transmission, are the lines, the high voltage lines that take power from those point sources of generation closer to population centers and take them to a substation that helps step down the voltage from high voltage to a lower voltage that's closer to what we need and to use in the home. And then the distribution line is really that last mile. So the last mile of wires from the substation to your home or whatever the point of consumption is. And then today, that distribution leg is getting a lot more interesting and complex because people are installing rooftop solar and batteries in their homes. They might have electric vehicle chargers. In some places, all those three segments, so generation, transmission, distribution, are owned by the same entity, and that might be your utility. There are some where those are all completely independent pieces. And so you might have an independent power producer, which is sometimes called merchant power, that's generating electricity when they get demand signals. And then a separate player is managing the actual retailing and interfacing with the customer. Whether people have one versus another structure is often determined by the market design. And so for an example, in the Midwest, there's an energy market called PJM, where people pay for something called capacity. So they will pay a generator to just be ready in case they're needed. And that's particularly useful in a place where there's, you know, cold weather and a lot of volatility in weather, because as you can imagine, you can have some energy spikes. And so it's useful just to have people sort of waiting in the wings, ready to dispatch. In other markets like Texas or the UK, or Australia, actually, there's just an energy market. And so the idea is like free markets, let's just put out demand signals at a certain price and people will generate in response to that demand signal. Now that works if weather is relatively predictable, but as we saw about a year ago in the Texas freeze, when the weather is volatile, then there might be a lag between that market price signal and when generators can actually respond. And so that's when you see crazy headlines about soaring electricity prices at certain moments. So market design is a huge influence in how this all comes together.
So let's say that I own a power facility. I'm a power producer, and I'm, you know, feeding my power to the grid, and I have the ability to, you know, regulate the amount that I am producing by firing up additional generators or, you know, whatever the mechanism might be. How do I know when to do that? What does that actually look like physically?
Yeah, there are these entities called independent system operators, or ISOs, that are essentially like the conductor or the orchestrator of the system. And so for them, they're often taking day ahead demand forecasts and basically sending signals to different generators saying, hey, we're going to need X percent of you to come online to respond to this demand. And how much orchestration there is can depend a little bit on the market structure. So in Australia, for example, or Texas, it's a totally deregulated market. And so there's less coordination or orchestration, especially among all the distributed energy resources, which could be, you know, your local Whole Foods or your home and all over the map and not quite have perfectly aligned incentives or information. And then in a market like California, there is a lot more orchestration, planning and centralization of the control and signals. So it depends a bit on the market. There's sort of an intermediate solution called DER aggregators that are layers that aggregate a bunch of scattered distributed energy resources. So for example, if a bunch of us have smart thermostats that can be controlled, electric vehicle chargers, et cetera, we can sync with a DER aggregator like Voltus or Ohm Connect or Leap to help monetize those resources and make sure that we're not all turning things on right when it's most expensive for us to do so.
So I'm very curious about that piece. So one can imagine that sort of the most efficient deployment of an electricity grid would combine things like, you know, predictive machine learning techniques with kind of universal standards, with real-time, you know, analytic feeds back to power generators. And there would be sort of this beautiful superstructure that would enable kind of most efficient power generation and end use consumption. So can you sort of give us a sense of how far away from such a thing are we today? And what is sort of the path to maybe achieve that, if that's the right target we should be thinking about?
Yeah, I think there are actually two different versions of the world that people advocate for. One is sort of what you're talking about, which is kind of more like a central super brain. And then the second is actually more of the Australia model, which is like extremely decentralized and deregulated, but with better information flows so that there's more real-time incorporation of market signals. But in terms of either state, frankly, we're pretty far away from that. So as an example, there's a company called Line Vision that enables people who own transmission lines. So if you're a utility that owns a transmission line, you can monitor it and change its capacity based on the amount of demand in the day. But the hard thing is the grid and the IT systems that the grid uses is not able to really do that in real time. And so instead, what's really happening in practice is people are printing day ahead, full day schedules for where they think the demand is going to be, and then programming these like somewhat dynamic systems to react to that. So there's so many pieces to this that there is no silver bullet that will make the grid be able to, you know, hum in harmony tomorrow. I think we might be 10 to 15 years away from what you're describing.
You could imagine that, and maybe I'm just hearing you talk about this makes me think, like, could you imagine a technology consisting of essentially like various coils that you could sort of wrap around existing transmission lines, you know, to sort of build on top of a grid? So you wouldn't have to do anything invasive necessarily, but you'd clasp these coils around lines and then understand how much power is passing through them and basically build a visualization, a data stream showing exactly where power is being used and how much of it, and sell that to suppliers, you know, and maybe you pay a rental fee for the right to do that on top of transition, you know, existing transmission lines, but your margin is the delta between that and what you sell your data for. Is anyone doing anything like that?
I have not come across someone who's doing exactly that end to end. There are pieces of it. There's a company called David Energy that's either launching or has launched in Texas, where what they do is they give people a Nest Smart thermostat and become their retailer. And so the idea is as you as customers want to adopt, you know, the smart thermostat and the solar panel and like all these things in your home, your traditional utility might not be able to even know how to bill you or measure the net impact of all those different pieces that you have. Plus, then you might have to deal with a separate bill from Tesla and a separate bill from Sunrun and a separate bill from your utility. And so companies like David Energy and Arcadia, which is in our portfolio, help to pull those things into a single bill and make it digestible for the consumers. There are a lot of high voltage transmission line technologies that are being deployed, especially in China, where there's a lot of greenfield infrastructure being built. The sad reality is it's really hard to build new transmission in the US. And so to your point of like retrofitting, like that's probably our best hope, but like what you're describing doesn't come to mind and it would be hard to build and hard to monetize.
Yeah. And what excites you, I guess, in terms of the opportunities for investment in grid infrastructure? Where are the places that you think make the most sense to be looking at?
Yeah. So I described what David Energy and Arcadia are doing, where they're helping small businesses and homes adapt to a distributed energy future and make that transition easier. So for example, if you as a consumer can't install rooftop solar for whatever reasons, maybe you're a renter, maybe the home form factor doesn't allow for it. With Arcadia, you can access community solar really quickly and efficiently and save money. So companies like that are really reducing friction on the consumer adoption side. Another set of companies that I highlight are the DER aggregators. So companies like Voltus and Ohm Connect are helping consumers and small businesses install DERs and then monetize them. Because you as if you're running a Whole Foods or a Dollar General, you don't want to be spending hours and hours optimizing your energy load. And it's frankly a pretty technical problem. And so Voltus can come in and just be your service provider and take it off your hands. That's another segment basically we've seen a lot of VC investment in. Then there are companies thinking about integrating EVs onto the grid. So companies in your home that install charging boxes or ways for you to easily upgrade your home to be EV ready. So Wallbox, for example. And then the other set is companies that are selling to utilities to help them manage the influx of EVs onto the grid. So some approaches have been companies like WeaveGrid that do more planning and software-based planning for those utilities. Then there are companies like FreeWire or Electric Era that are installing batteries essentially to help utilities manage the load at that specific point of consumption. A third is around heat pumps and electrification of the home and everything to do with that. And so some companies are selling the actual heat pump themselves and the installation. So that's Dandelion, which is doing geothermal, or Sensible, which is installing air source heat pumps. Then there are companies that are taking more of a service provider approach. So Sealed, for example, is building almost like a Sunrun, but for weatherization of homes.
For people who may not be familiar with Sunrun, can you just describe what you mean?
Yeah, of course. So Sunrun basically makes it really easy for you as a consumer to get solar in your home. So they'll come in, like help you figure out what size of system you need, just make the installation smooth. And so by the Sunrun of weatherization, I mean a company where you can just go onto the website and say, I have this, you know, home that was built in the early 1900s. I want to figure out how to modernize it and get an electric stove and heat pumps and all of that. And so companies like Sealed will just connect you with the right contractors and help you get a clear price estimate of what it'll charge you and then provide financing for those projects. So I think, you know, companies that are reducing friction are probably the most interesting for VCs to play right now.
And so, you know, I think that there's a huge disparity in terms of the degree to which people understand what's possible in terms of, you know, in solar installation and sort of installation of batteries. I wonder if you could explain what is sort of the model if someone wants to install solar and wants to install, you know, batteries in the home, how does that typically work, or how can that work? And perhaps touching on even selling power back to the grid, either from your EV or from your home battery or from your home solar installation. How does that work?
Yeah. So for getting solar, I'd say there are two paths. One is going to your local solar dealer, and there are tons of small dealers all across the United States that are essentially selling solar panels and systems from multiple providers. And so they can help you with figuring out what system to spec and how big of a system you need, et cetera. The second is to go straight to a brand you recognize. You could go to a Sunrun or Tesla. So I think those are like the main two paths of just where to even start. And then in terms of monetizing it and how to get that stuff onto the grid, there are a few different providers. So Voltus is more of the provider if you're a small business or a small commercial or industrial player. So there are Bitcoin miners on Voltus, there are industrial facilities on Voltus, and there are grocery stores on Voltus. Whereas on the residential side, there's Ohm Connect, which can help connect your smart thermostat and help you monetize any demand reductions, for example, that you might have and convert that to cash. There are other like layers to that. There's a company called Leap that works with the different set of resources you might have. So for example, if you have a Nest thermostat or a Tesla Powerwall, Leap can be the layer that helps you take that and bid it into the utility markets. Mm-hmm. And so from your perspective, you're probably just using whichever app came with that distributed energy resource, but on the back end, they're working with Leap to help you interface with the energy markets.
Hmm. How does that actually work though? How does that monetization occur?
So what Leap does is they'll go to the ISO. For example, California's ISO and say, hey, in 2 years, we're going to have X amount of gigawatts of capacity for peak use in August, which is like one of the hardest months for California because of the heat and wildfires and everything. So California ISO is like, great, here's a contract if you can do that. And then Leap has this like basically contracted demand. And then they go and they match a bunch of supply against it. So then they'll go and they'll broker deals with Nest and with Tesla or another, you know, battery or solar provider. And then at the time that event occurs, it's on Leap to make sure that these resources are bid in. And so they send signals basically to all the different resources that they've contracted with. And said like, hey, here's the moment and we've got to go deliver. And so that's sort of how it happens in practice. Like Leap is sort of like a giant broker that creates these brokers, these contracts.
Interesting. So essentially the ISO will say, okay, you know, it would be nice for us if we had X amount of power that was produced on this day in August, because we know that's going to be a tough day. So Leap will say, okay, we can do that because we think that with our new business pipeline, the number of distributed entities that are coming on board that we're signing contracts with, those devices will be either producing or saving that mm-hmm. amount, because it could be saving too, right?
Yeah.
Right. Absolutely. So, and presumably if it's a contractual obligation, they'll have to oversubscribe that commitment, because if they can't really control whether you're mm-hmm. using your Nest that day, you might not be using it or, you know.
Yeah.
So they probably have to dramatically oversubscribe that commitment with end use devices.
Yeah, they do. And then they probably build a portfolio where there might be some B2B fleets that are easier to have some sort of, you know, punitive arrangement with, which is like, you know, we have agreed to have X percent of capacity from the EV chargers at Whole Foods. And if Whole Foods like turns on one of them during that hour, then like there's a fine. I think it's a delicate balance, but I think by creating that portfolio that is oversubscribed and that has a percentage of B2B and B2C, that's how they deliver against those contracts.
Yeah, that could be quite harrowing if you're in that position. but that's fascinating. And is that generally how, if, you know, for people who have solar and who say they are selling power back to the grid, quote unquote, is it by that mechanism that they do so, or are there other ways in which that's done?
Yeah, it can be done through the OEM itself. So I've been giving the example of Tesla with Leap because it's just a recognizable brand, but actually Tesla has their own scheduler and you can just bid directly and Tesla will go on contract, basically demand directly with the ISO. And so, you know, often net metering, as it's called, which is like selling solar back to the grid, is done through a mechanism like what I described, but at the back end, basically it's the OEM who's created an app where that's a consumer's interface, but they've partnered with someone like a Leap to dispatch onto the grid.
Mm-hmm. Great. So how would you break down the opportunity space when it comes to decarbonizing the electricity grid? Where are the levers and how big are those levers respectively?
Yeah. So if we think about generation and then transmission and then distribution, and then the last piece I'll add on to that is like end use. So for the first one, generation, the main opportunities people are going after today are storage. So for renewables, for example, the cost of solar has come down tremendously over the past 15 years, thanks to investments by a number of governments and a lot of scale up of private sector manufacturing of solar panels. The challenge, though, is if we the sun is shining, you know, in the middle of the day, which is not necessarily when people are using the most electricity. And so in the middle of the day, you almost have overgeneration relative to demand. And then when everyone goes home after their work day, they all, you know, turn on their cook stoves, maybe they turn on the dishwasher, and the demand is now peaked, but the sun is down. And so the way to get around that is by using energy storage. And so a lot of what people are funding is either new ways of packaging energy storage or creating easy to install temperature resistant battery packs that might be made from used EV batteries, because there just aren't enough new battery cells to like package into these storage systems. A second is finding ways of getting new types of storage. So today, traditional lithium ion, some packs last 4 hours, some packs last 8 hours, but that's not enough, of course, if you have like 3 days of no sunshine. And so companies like Form Energy are trying to solve that problem by building multi-day storage. And that's where a lot of venture dollars are going. And then the other like really moonshot things are nuclear. So there's a lot of investment going into advanced fission and then nuclear fusion as well, because that's seen as the holy grail of unlocking, frankly, carbon zero, unlimited amounts of energy. So that's on the generation side. On the transmission and distribution side, there's a lot of infrastructure investment going into making transmission line upgrades and building some new transmission. There's not a ton of that happens in the US because of just challenges around getting those projects done, frankly. There are a few edge things like companies like Line Vision and Smart Wires that help utilities orchestrate power through the, but those are sort of on the margins. And then the last piece on distribution and point of consumption. We talked about EV charging. There are new types of electric panels and then heat pumps. So those are the set of opportunities across the spectrum. I'd say the most opportunity for venture is at the distribution and point of consumption piece. The most opportunity for infrastructure investors is in the generation and transmission piece.
Just to double click on one aspect of what you just described, on the nuclear piece, there have been a lot of sort of differences of opinion about whether nuclear is actually necessary to kind of supply what some people, I think, erroneously call baseload demand. The concept is that, you know, the intermittency of renewable energy supply is such that you need kind of a stable, you know, baseline of power generation. I'm wondering where you come out on that question. Do you think that nuclear is necessary on some level? Or do you think that advances in renewable energy production plus, you know, these distributed storage systems will be sufficient?
I think the climate crisis ultimately is too urgent to not have multiple bets going. And so my personal take is, you know, I can create sort of a theoretical construct where with multi-day storage, you know, assuming Form is super successful, we can stitch together renewables plus multi-day storage, get rid of all the gas, and get to this perfectly clean energy future. But in reality, I would rather have multiple shots on goal. And so I think nuclear is an important part of the answer. And countries like France have had 80% of their energy from nuclear without major incident. You know, of course, I understand that there's a lot of emotional and you know, justified fear of nuclear based on things that have happened in the past. But at the end of the day, I think if we're investing in advanced nuclear and fusion, it's critical for our future as humanity, frankly.
Mm-hmm. Do you have any any thoughts in terms of changes or progress in the realm of decarbonization, decarbonizing the grid from the infrastructure bill?
Yeah, I do think it is transformative for some specific technologies like carbon, like battery recycling, that are somewhat bipartisan and also important for national security and energy security for the U.S. I mean, it's too soon to have the actual impact of the programs be realized. But I'm seeing some demand signal from the bill and signals that there will be cheaper capital available to companies that are doing really bold things. So, for example, there are hundreds of millions of dollars for battery recycling facilities in the infrastructure bill. You know, these aren't companies that I think would have raised these rounds even, you know, a year and a half, 2 years ago. So I do think that there are some signals of at least capital availability that's important from the infrastructure bill, even if like it hasn't actually been deployed yet. It's more the expectation.
Yeah, that makes sense. You know, that does get to another final question for you that I had, which is, you know, proven technology, proven ability of the company to commercialize the technology. These two things together are quite challenging. So you want to be investing in companies that have proven their ability to deliver on both counts. That said, you know, once a company has proven their ability to do this on both counts, isn't the landscape then just incredibly competitive for those deals in that you have, you know, you're then in the realm of sort of a lot of these private equity firms that would target similar profile investments? Is that the case, or is there still a sweet spot where a firm like G2 can play?
Yeah, I'd say there's definitely still a sweet spot, because a lot of these companies, you know, even if they've proven that they can sell established technology a couple of times, there's a lot to go from that, all the, you know, from like the 5-10 million of revenue they might have at that point, all the way to 100+ million of revenue, at which point, you know, we and they would start thinking about an exit. And so much breaks along the way in that particular stage of the journey. There's so much company building to be done at that stage of the journey. And so it's not quite, I think the sweet spot is where there is enough company building to do that you can't have someone just come in, write a check and walk away. The company is looking for an advisor and someone who's experienced to be on their board. And so that's how I describe where we play. In the last quarter, Q4 2021, maybe parts of Q3 2021, we did see a number of crossover funds come in to earlier and earlier stages, even doing Series A's. I think it's hard, and we'll see. I don't think the jury's out on the impact of these hedge funds in the long run. And our sweet spot is very much companies that are still building and, you know, haven't quite figured it out and still want that experienced hand.
Well, thank you so much, Monica. This was so fun and so informative. I feel like I learned a huge amount just hearing you talk. So I really appreciate your willingness to be part of this conversation. Thank you.
Absolutely. Thanks for having me.
That was Monica Varman from G2 Venture Partners. Climate Now is made possible in part by our science partners like the Livermore Lab Foundation. The Livermore Lab Foundation supports climate research and carbon cleanup initiatives at the Lawrence Livermore National Lab, which is a Department of Energy applied science and research facility. For more information on the foundation's climate work, visit livermorelabfoundation.org. To check out other interviews from Climate Now, or to watch our videos and sign up for our newsletter, visit climatenow.com. And if you'd like to get in touch, you can email us at contact@climatenow.com or tweet us @WeAreClimateNow. We hope you'll join us for our next conversation.